Hey everybody, Nate here. Before the show, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about our sponsor, the Snack Nanny. The Snack Nanny is the latest, greatest spill-proof bowl. It's the first snack bowl for kids with a self-closing door. The Snack Nanny allows kids to snack freely without overeating, keeps kids entertained, and prevents them from creating a mess for mom and dad to clean up. Kids and parents love the Snack Nanny. It's easy to use, easy to clean, and includes portion control features that only the Snack Nanny offers. To order, go to www.snacknanny.com or order through Amazon. Remember, you support our sponsors, and they support us. Thanks, and Nihei Dibiru. Hey everybody, and welcome to another African edition of Chop Talk. I'm your host, Nate England. Today's guest is Peter Benson. Peter is the senior consultant at Greyhead Consulting, which focuses on management coaching, strategy and business plan development, and market research for businesses of any size. Peter was a huge help to me during my time in South Africa, showing me around the country, and he even let me crash at his house for a couple of days. The funny thing was that before my trip, nobody bothered to tell me that Peter was a karate guy. So it was kind of nice to get there and find out that we had something to talk about. Peter sat down with me for an interview that covered everything from politics to business to, of course, martial arts. And I hope you enjoy listening to the interview as much as I did giving it. Thanks.
We're going to start doing karate stories. We got to get ready for the podcast.
Oh, Lordy.
Yeah.
But it was... and you battled to try and get that, because I didn't have that body mass to compete
just,
against
kind of a
boys.
Tall, skinny beanpole.
That's it. I mean, when I was 20, I was weighing in at 82 kgs already. So then they pushed me up. And so the only thing I could do was actually use speed.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just couldn't afford to be... caught by one of the big boys.
You can't just stand there and
hammer it out. No, no, and take it out. No, right. You can't hammer it out. Yeah. No, and that's one of the reasons why now, as I get older, where you actually start looking at, no, I've used that whole tactic throughout my career, is get in quick and fast and get out. So using pure speed. Now it's get in and make sure he doesn't stand up. First shot.
Take him out.
But you do. You know. It was actually unfair, and I kept on going back to these guys and saying, come on, guys. I mean, it's my height that's given me the weight and not the body mass that's given me the weight.
Right.
You were 85 kgs heavyweight.
Oh, yeah.
I remember sitting there as a junior. I think I was about 15 years old. And facing a guy now who was 92 kgs, I was 85 kgs. And the boy was about 4 feet across his shoulders. And I looked at him and I thought, no, 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 no. This can't go beyond the first round. Otherwise, I'm not going to survive. but it is, it's fun.
What was the style that you said you'd start in?
Shutokai.
What's the sort of background on that?
It comes actually. If I've got it correct, it's not a pure Japanese martial art.
Okay.
It is a Southeast Asian, let's say. Blend. It comes from monasteries, monks,
okay,
as per the originals as well. So it's very much a lifestyle rather than anything else. Mm. If I had to, let's say, define the style, it's a defensive style versus an attack style.
Okay.
It's open hand. so is the fundamental around it. Open hand and cat stance. So okay. You're on your toes. You're up.
A little bit light.
Very light.
Moving around.
Very
light. So you doing the speed stuff,
speed,
moving around.
Speed and skill out. versus power. Mm. And we were taught, you know, how to focus a lot quicker the chi. So as you came in, your focus was a lot sharper.
Mm.
And you had to do it. Because here in South Africa, JKA was the predominant style. Goju-ryu.
Okay. Goju and Shotokan are the two big ones down here.
Correct. You know, under the JKA Association, run by, and I'm not even going to say it, run by a cabal, who, yeah, I mean, like, I think any organization becomes political in its own way.
Yeah.
And therefore, if they didn't quite approve your style or didn't like you you were cut out.
Right.
From tournaments and that type of thing.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. When I was living in Okinawa when they did the most recent World Karate Championships, and so I'm like, all right, well, I'm living here, so I might as well jump in. You know, I don't have to make an extra flight over. And they said, oh, no. You studied Shuri-ryu, and Shuri-ryu is not allowed. And I'm like, all right, well, who is allowed? It's like only the styles where the head person is in Okinawa are allowed to enter the Karate World Championships.
Oh.
And so I started going through this list. I'm like, how about Shotokan? And he says, if the Shotokan dojo is in Okinawa,
then
you can join.
Okay.
And I went through this whole list of other ones, like, no.
So it had to be based in Okinawa?
Yeah. But that's the way they are. I don't think the Okinawans realize that everyone, if you're in karate, you know, everyone outside of Okinawa really, this is where it started.
Mm.
And so they sort of give them credit. I think they have a little bit more of a contentious relationship with the Japanese. Yeah. So the Japanese are like, we're better than Okinawans, but we started it. You know? And so they're very sort of standoffish about anybody else who comes in. They want to do their own little thing.
And that's, you know, to me, here, and I look at more the philosophy of it rather than the actual skill. The skill is brilliant, is something that you need to train in.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the philosophy, and South Africa, because it's a violent society per se, karate fundamentally was introduced in this country as more of an ability to fight rather than a way of life.
Mm.
Or a mindset. It was once I got my black belt, or from brown and upwards, I could go and beat the shit out of somebody else, and that really was the fundamental. And I think the whole organization within South Africa came from that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the training methodology here as well, especially under JKA, mm-hmm. was all power building. Build power and build size.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're not using your natural gifts and trying to hone skill and speed.
Mm-hmm.
You were trying to overpower someone by mere brute force.
Right.
And mere brute force then has its drawbacks.
Sure.
Because you then become inflexible.
Mm-hmm.
You're unable to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
You're not as fast.
Mm-hmm.
So it is. Look, it's been one of those. I don't know. I've stayed away from it here in South Africa for now 25 years.
No, but you were in it for about 30.
30 years, right. Yeah. So, it was mainly at Wits University.
Okay.
That we were training. It was small clubs. In fact, since you've been here, I did a little search around and phoned a couple of guys as well. There's two clubs still in Shutokai.
Mm.
In the country.
It wasn't big when you were in it either. No. You said there was just a handful of guys.
Correct.
30 guys?
12 of us started. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I think when we were traveling and competing, mm-hmm. There were 30 of us countrywide.
Wow.
Now, it was very small. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't accepted within South Africa, because it wasn't what I would class one of the violent martial arts. People didn't see the benefit of speed and skill,
mm-hmm.
and mindset and philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got to say, now much later in life, without that type of training and background, I would never have achieved what I did in business without it. It taught me a hell of a lot, especially from the mind perspective about life and how to see life. The one thing that martial arts in South Africa, you have to do, because it is a violent society, the adaption is that you've got to start understanding your environment, everything about your environment, wherever you are, constantly. Now, it needs to become part of your nature and not something extra that you have to do. You know, your subconscious has to be aware that wherever you are, what is around you, who's around you, what are the escape routes, what's the attack routes, that type of thing, because that's the constant nature of this society. Until this society can mature a lot better and take violence up. But you're coming back to the basics. In Africa, as I said, it's not for sissies. And it's survival.
Was sissies the word that you used?
Yes.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's sissies. Yeah, this is not a continent for sissies.
Okay.
You have to be strong. But you've also got to be compassionate, I believe, in order to actually go forward. And until we can take out that need of South African society to react violently to disagreements, instead of sitting down and trying to negotiate or find common ground or to agree to disagree. Our first tendency here is, if I don't agree with you, then my reaction is violence.
Okay.
To you, to get you to agree with me.
Well, if you don't like it, I'm going to make you like it.
Correct. Yeah. I'm going to beat the shite out of you to it. So,
so is it getting closer to that? I mean, the one thing that I didn't realize when I got over here is, you know, the apartheid. I had read about it in social studies class in fourth grade, and I knew vaguely who Nelson Mandela was, but I didn't realize that, for example, it had gone until 1994. That it was still that far in. I mean, was there still a lot of leftover anger and aggression over that, or is it getting away from the violence, or is it still predominant?
No, I think we're going back into violence.
All right.
Now, I think as Nelson Mandela's influence has waned, now he taught us one very vital lesson, is that nothing is non-negotiable. And every negotiation is a compromise. By its very nature, it's a compromise. The minute that one side gets what it wants, that is not a win-win situation.
The other guys feel disenfranchised.
Straight away.
What else am I going to do? Correct. I can only rise up. Or I can
Nelson taught us, those who were prepared to listen. Now, and that quietened, and I thought we'd really have what everybody talks about as the Rainbow Nation. Because there is strength in diversity. But what we are seeing of late is this mad rush, and it's promoted by greed.
Okay.
Instantaneous wealth. Now, when you've got that, then it is, now, bugger women and children. It's trample over whoever it is in the way in order to enrich yourself. Now, is that a fallback from people who never had, who now desperately want and need immediately? I think our whole education of how we try to educate the population, that this is not going to be solved overnight, and you're not going to become instantaneous millionaires. It's going to require effort. But
just because you elect, I don't know who even the political guys are, just because this guy gets in office doesn't mean that you're going to move out of your shanty town and into a...
Immediately. Right. Correct. And there's a lot of that feeling around now is I am owed something from the state, or someone needs to give me something. Now, we've lost this ability of saying we actually have to work for something. So our education system is falling apart. It's something that they need to address, because that's where it starts. It is around education, literacy, around the population. But coming back to the question, I think that if we don't watch ourselves carefully, we are going to degenerate into like the rest of Africa, where it becomes the basic human, I'm stronger, I win. Mm.
To the victor go the spoils.
Exactly, exactly. So there is a big adjustment that's to come here. Are we going to be successful at it? I believe so. I think so. But it just requires enough disciples to promote the glass is half full, not half empty, and proceed from there.
We mentioned education system. So obviously, before 94, everything was segregated, but now it's integrated. And I was told that supposedly, no matter who you are, you're allowed to get in the government schools.
Yes.
So I don't know if that's actually in place, but that's the rule.
It's correct, but you then need the schools, and then you still need the qualified teachers. Mm. So there hasn't been enough effort around the infrastructure of schooling to actually honor that commitment.
It's a glorified daycare instead of... The kids aren't... They just go here, but they're not necessarily learning what the skills, the reading,
correct,
the writing...
Correct, correct. And you're going to find that let's call them the care keepers, aren't even qualified care keepers. Mm. So, you know, it's like getting a reprobate to teach young reprobates.
Those are the worst kind.
But, look, you know, I think people have got a misconception. You know, apartheid as itself, as is known under the humanities, because of what it was said. Now, worldwide, people never said it. It was only the Nationalist Party in South Africa who actually had a name for it, apartheid.
Okay.
And apartheid was separate development, co-development was their core. They understood the tribal issues within South Africa. The rest of the world saw that as forcing the divisions between the tribes, and
that's the other thing that I think people from the outside, especially the U.S., don't realize. You look at it, and okay, here's the white people, and here's the black people, and so this is where the line was drawn. But it's not that. There are, I don't know, a dozen different competing tribes in Africa. And then you have the whole issue of there's a decent Indian population, decent Muslim population, and, you know, even South Asian. So that line was sort of zigzagging around to include some, and others, other groups that were pushed off.
I mean, fundamentally, there was some really, in a pre-1994, if you were in the humane area, the National Party tried to do was fundamentally wrong against, let's call it, human rights. Mm-hmm. But there was a principle behind it of saying that we as the Afrikaner, and even us as English speaking, we were basically segregated.
Okay.
Against, because the Afrikaans white population was the majority. Mm-hmm. Even though your lingo de Franco is English, in business, the majority of the whites in South Africa were Afrikaans. Calvinistic in their thinking, which is very conservative. Mm-hmm.
It was a religious group, yes, that came down, right? So just like the Pilgrims came over to the U.S., so somebody else came down here.
Well, they were called the Huguenots.
Okay.
You know, they were being persecuted in Europe. So it was a branch of Christianity. Calvinism came across here. It grew. It became very conservative. They thought through their own way. Yep, I mean, and every religion interprets the Bible the way that they want to interpret the Bible.
And it's the correct way.
Correct, and they all believe it's the correct way. I mean, I think religion is just another political party. really, I do. I see no advantage. And in fact, specializing in marketing, religion has what we call fear marketing as the cornerstone of their principle. And it's the fear of. If you don't believe in what I'm telling you that you must believe in, you are going to go to hell, and I'll describe hell for you. Horns, fire, and brimstone.
I don't want to go there.
Correct. Fear. Straight away, fear. Mm-hmm. So there's... The country has enormous potential. Enormous potential. Mm. The demographics of the country are a specific challenge. As we were talking earlier, young population, too few contributing to the tax. Therefore, it's going to take a long, hard slog. However, capitalism is not the answer.
Mm.
I believe a combination of capitalism and socialism.
All right.
Is the answer for the African continent.
Okay.
Where you cannot have the capitalists keep on year on year chasing more and more profit for their back pocket.
So this is what I think the first day I was here, you mentioned that. So the capitalism is we have to show a profit every year.
Yes.
And if we don't get this profit every year...
And it must grow every year. Not just we must have a 20% profit every year. We must have a 20% profit this year, and next year we must have a 22%, and the following year we've got to have a 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're chasing capitalism, you're forever chasing the increasing of your return.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's got to come a line at some stage where if you are increasing your return, you are now starting to drop, whether it's the environment, the community, your employees behind.
Because mm-hmm.
you're only chasing one goal. You're not putting it back in.
Mm-hmm.
So a combination of capitalism and socialism. Capitalism has its advantages,
mm-hmm.
but also has major disadvantages. Mm-hmm. Socialism has also its disadvantages.
Mm-hmm.
But in an African context, it's much more appropriate.
Hey everybody, remember, if you have an upcoming seminar, tournament, or other martial arts event, let us know, and we'd be happy to announce it on the program. And now, back to the show.
Because they're looking more long-term, they're putting the infrastructure in place, they're getting the education to everybody. Is that what you're...
Yes, we've got to start there.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like anything else, and we were talking earlier about within the various dojos and the various styles, you know, politics actually is a hurdle in completing what should be done for education.
Yeah.
You know, more teacher training colleges should be put up. More emphasis on training the teachers and encouraging them into that environment.
Mm-hmm.
More discipline in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, we've gone the other way around, where in fact I think in this country the perpetrator of violence and or bad deed has the same, if not more, rights than the victim.
All right.
And that poses problems.
Mm.
Because in the eye of the consumer or the citizen, there's no justice there. He did wrong. How can he be afforded privileges
and
having
free
done
medical
wrong?
Care.
Correct. I mean,
well, they get free medical care.
Well, where do you find that because I did wrong in society and I've got to be taken out of society and put into a prison service, mm-hmm. I now have also rights and I have the right to vote.
Oh, you get to vote from prison?
Oh, yes. I've got the right to vote still.
So, if I run it for political office in South Africa, I'm going to say, I will release everybody from prison.
Hey, there we go. There you get all the voters.
Yeah.
It's actually a sick form. In fact, it's taken human rights all the way the wrong way.
Mm.
But I believe in the principles or the philosophies in the martial arts. Now, those philosophies turn around and saying that because, one, it is not it's a betterment of self. It's the improvement of self
mm-hmm.
and the improvement of the community and the environment that I'm in. And it's not just purely the improvement of myself
mm-hmm.
at the expense of
mm-hmm.
the environment or the community.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can really adopt that philosophy and practice what we preach,
mm-hmm.
I actually see a far better environment. I mean, right now, I think I could have been killed a couple of times, family damaged badly, if it wasn't for my martial art training.
Hmm.
the ability to respond quickly, the ability to assess a situation, the ability to decide fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
Now, martial arts gives you that extra few seconds.
Right.
In deciding whether I fight or flight. Because here you've got either, when you hit a violent situation, the normal reaction of a human being freezes.
Like a deer in the headlights.
Yes, exactly.
What do I do?
Now, martial arts takes out those, let's call them freezing seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Allows the brain to still work.
Mm-hmm.
To actually make that decision for you. Mm-hmm. Fight or flight. And that is what I'd like to try and get that type of principle into every human being. Is that stop and think. But how do you get them to stop and think?
Right.
Before you react.
I remember about that time you and Nick were hijacked, darling.
Yeah, no.
Oh, you were hijacked?
Yeah, yeah.
Attempted
hijack. No, right. It was attempted purely because of my martial art training. If I was just like a normal citizen, no. Potentially, we could have lost our lives. A car, BMW, came in. I was riding in those days only Mercedes-Benz.
Okay. Not a bad way to go around.
Yeah, but a Mercedes-Benz is a sought-after vehicle. And it's definitely it's a vehicle of the haves versus the have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
And driving around, picked him up from his girlfriend one evening. It wasn't late at night. Coming back home, came down towards the robots.
Yeah, by the garage.
But because I was constantly aware of my surroundings, in other words, I was aware of a vehicle coming up from behind, I was aware of my surroundings, and suddenly the vehicle behind me started to accelerate faster than that what was required on this road when I was heading towards a robot.
Mm-hmm.
So my suspicions were roused.
Something is wrong. Correct. I don't know what it is, but there is something wrong.
So the brain was now active and was ready to make that decision. Mm-hmm. This BMW cut in front of us. Four guys jumped out. Two of them with guns.
Wow.
Straight away. Now, my immediate reaction, instantaneously, was grabbing Nick from behind the neck, pushed him down below the dashboard,
mm-hmm.
put the Mercedes into reverse, and floored it. They still shot at me. They managed to hit the car with two shots.
Wow.
One in the radiator, and the one right in front of me that hit where the windscreen wipe is. Yeah. So now I carry that
the
bullet.
The road's on a bit of an incline. So, I mean, if it had been flat, it would have come through the windscreen.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, but my reaction, as I backed away now, then my South African streak came out and said, attack. Because I've given myself distance. They were more stunned than I were because they were still standing in the middle of the road,
mm-hmm.
with their guns out, but now no victim. Now I'm 100 meters back,
mm-hmm.
suddenly. And I thought, well, I've got a car that's a ton and a half.
Right.
Put the foot down onto the corner metal, and I can get up to 140 kilometers very quickly, and I can take four of them out and their car quite easily. But in those nanoseconds of that decision, because that was my reaction, now I'm standing there, my temper was now up and saying, you dared try this.
Right.
Okay, now you must pay for this.
Mm.
But within those nanoseconds was thinking, I've got my son with me. And I couldn't endanger him.
Right. And you know, these guys are already willing to shoot. And
that's the other thing.
It sounds like their goals may have been a little bit more nefarious than just, hey, get out of the car.
Yes. Because it's a violent society.
Mm. If they pull out a gun, they're going to use it. They're not one of those ones who are going to wuss around with a gun. If they pull a gun, they're going to use
you
it.
You see.
You can be guaranteed.
And then we go back to those history. Mm. Because, yes, they are. There's people from whatever tribes they are, that they are going to hold anger that they can't get rid of after this transformation that has happened, mm-hmm. since 1994. So, will he shoot because he was now hijacking a white person? The likelihood was yes.
Right.
He would have.
Mm-hmm.
Would I have reacted violently to this attack because I was a white and they were black? The answer is yes.
Hmm.
I was not scared to react to that violence.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was going to attack it. You see, so
come
and that's the philosophy that I try and work with people and say, listen, there is no need to get up to that state of mind where you have to actually attack to that type of level. Because now, that level, when you are trained in the martial arts, I'm not going to be attacking to hurt you or to push you away. I'm attacking to kill you.
Right. It's all or nothing.
Correct.
Yeah.
You're going to kill. You're not going to hurt his arm or give him a bruise or a black eye.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the danger that we face in this society, where you are pushed to those levels where insanity prevails. I mean, we've seen it in our strikes that take place here. Now, why are they violent? They shouldn't be violent.
Why are they torching the...
Yeah, they should not be violent. They've got the right to protest.
Yeah. Yes, we need more money. We won't work until we get it. They didn't need to hack police officers to death with machetes, right?
Or burn people, which is what they did.
And then the other side will come back and do the same thing.
Exactly. Of course.
Yeah. Now, there's a whole lot of debates. Now, was education better pre-1994?
You fool. What are you doing in there?
That's a German Shepherd trying to reverse into a small parking space. So it's an issue that we have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
It's an issue we have to deal with rationally. But I come back and say, without martial art training, it would have, and many other instances that I've been involved in, would have landed up wrong.
See, that's what is interesting to me, how the people will take it, where they learned it when they were young or older, whenever they learned it, and then apply it to what they're doing in their life.
Yes.
So it's not just, I'm going to run this karate school and this is how I'm going to make my living. It's interesting to me to see the people and say, this is how I applied it, or this got me out of this situation, or this is what...
I see martial art training dojos, specifically down at the dojo level, as actually part of the education system.
It's like a mentor.
Not as something separate and individual. Here we see it as something separate and individual. Yep, you've got the few and the good guys there who see it as a sport.
Right.
The others, the majority, see it as a means to give me the tools to attack.
Mm-hmm.
The discipline, I think that's a very big part of it.
That's why if we can get the martial arts as part of the education, in fact the philosophy of martial art in there. Why do humans attack one another? It's fear that actually does that. Fear is actually caused by a number of issues, but one of the fundamentals is that I don't love myself. I don't have confidence in myself. And therefore, how do I show my lack of confidence? I lash out at people. Martial arts actually give you the confidence in yourself, in the ability of yourself, your brain, your body, your thoughts. Now, if we take all of that, I move my martial art training right into business. I would not have been as successful as I was without martial arts.
So you were with Exxon Mobil.
Correct.
Initially.
I first started with Barclays Bank. I was within the bank, so I was a financial guy. Then, 10 years after working with them, I was headhunted by Mobil Oil.
Okay.
Yeah. And stayed with them the rest of my life, and then traveled throughout the world, and worked throughout the world with them.
Yeah, they sent you into some pretty hairy places.
Oh, very hairy, very hairy.
When he was doing his Africa stuff.
Yeah, the DRC. When they overthrew Mobutu Sese Seko.
What was his name again?
Mobutu Sese Seko.
Okay.
Okay, he was... but supported by the West. He was a puppet president supported by the West, but as corrupt as you could find. Now, the West has this whole history behind them of supporting dictators that are, just because they are Western influence, are supporting them. So this is the two-facedness that you see of the Western world.
All right.
Where they talk about the humanities, but support and prop up dictatorial regimes just because it's in their interests.
Well, we have to have somebody that can take a bribe and keep all the uppity folks in line.
Exactly.
I mean, what do you expect us to do?
Exactly. Now, I don't mind that if we're more honest about it.
Okay.
But that's what gets me, is the dishonesty of us in this. Mm-hmm. And we walk around with our Bible in the one hand, and in the other hand we're shouting about the humanities and how people and life and everything else. However, behind the scenes, we have our CIA and our FBI and our SISs and MI6s and all the rest of those boys.
Causing absolute chaos.
Supporting financially, materially, those type of regimes that actually should never exist in this new modern world that we are coming into. And, I was in this DRC where the current president, Kabila, of the DRC, his father, also Kabila, ousted this Sese Seko.
Okay.
And I was in this little town called Lubumbashi. Now, Central Africans, on average, their average height is about 5'6", 5'7".
All right.
Is their average height.
We're getting into pygmy territory.
Correct. At six... at
average.
Six, yeah, average height. And very... their skin is a darker hue of... black, what we call black.
Okay.
It's fundamentally brown, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a dark, it was a very dark skin hue that they've got. So now at a 6'3" white, you tended to stand out like a lamppost wherever you went.
Right.
Now, I was standing in this crowd in Lubumbashi. Now, as the soldiers were coming in, Kabila's, the current president's father, and the next minute I felt this cold metal in my left ear. Every now and then I can still feel the cold metal, you know. And I turned to see, and was one very drunk or stone soldier with an Uzi stuck right in my ear. Demanding all sorts of things. Now, you know, if I was not trained, I think I would have just shat myself, wet my pants, and potentially died in the shithole called Lubumbashi.
Oh, and I would probably have never known what happened to him.
Correct. But because of my martial art training, and it is only nanoseconds if you're looking at it from the outside, but when you're in these conflicts, it seems like...
it slows down.
Correct. It seems like... and the martial art gave me, and does give me, longer minutes, longer seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Because within those nanoseconds that I reacted, I'd looked, I'd worked out that he was out of his tree. Okay. That the safety catch on the Uzi was still in a locked position.
Mm.
So I was knowing and seeing those things instantaneously.
We've been in the army also, yeah. So, you know, we did army military service.
It was compulsory.
Yes, no, yeah, you were pulled into that whether you liked it or not. So I was able to deflect the Uzi out, disarm him, put his butt onto the ground, and then for me to duck as quickly as possible. Because I'm the lone 6 foot white. Now,
and if anyone's coming to someone's aid, they're coming to his.
It's correct.
Not yours.
No, not mine. And because of the martial art training, it wasn't like a big
issue.
Conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to do it relatively quietly and very quickly. So he was down and out, cold, gone. By the time I reckon that anybody noticed this drunk soldier on the floor, I was a good 3 kilometers away from the site. I was gone. Now, I was now heading for the border, which is the Zambian border and Ndola. So now I'm in a hired car. An Avis hired car going through the jungles, going down towards Ndola. As I come up to the border and I see the armies, both armies, the Zambian army and the DRC army, all over this border post.
Okay.
I now abandon this Avis hired car in a village near the border post. Now, when we talk about villages, we're not talking about Western villages,
okay,
in your mind. You're talking about huts, thatch huts, mud walls, chickens, goats.
What I thought I was going to see when I came to Johannesburg.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So that's all you saw, but there were army personnel all the way around him. So I'm thinking, so now I abandoned a white Volkswagen Jetta in the middle of this brown, dirty, desolate little town. So that must itself stood out like a sore.
Even your car was white.
Even the car was white. I was in a suit because I was up there in business. Then I decided I was actually going to crash the border. Now, what sane person sits there and thinks they're going to go and crash a border post with two armies on high alert? But because of both my martial art training as well as my army training, it was an obstacle that had to be tackled, and not, I couldn't avoid it. It wasn't something I could walk away from.
Right.
Because now I was sandwiched between Lubumbashi, big revolution, army, guns, everything else, and this border post and so-called freedom in Zambia.
You now, had to do something. You didn't know what. You had to figure out what.
Whoever thought getting into Zambia would be freedom? I mean, and that's the relativity in Africa, because Zambia is not much better. But I then dashed through the little village, snuck up behind, waited an opportunity, shot across, jumped over the barrier on the Zambian side, physically grabbed the passport entry stamp from the Zambian official and stamped my own passport. And then said to them, they can do what they like with me. I'm now officially in Zambia.
All right, everybody. That does it for part one of my interview with Peter Benson. I'd just like to thank Peter again for taking the time to sit down and talk with me. As always, make sure you send your questions or comments to choptalkwithnateengland@gmail.com. And make sure you tune in next week for part two of the interview. Thanks for listening. Bye. Bas, je le pas, il m'a charas, et que si bas.